The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
This is Richard Martin here. This is your Friday wake-up call. It is the 14th of May, 2010, and let's see what we have for you for the full hour, starting with an account which I came across of what, frankly, I can only describe as a typical reaction between a vendor and a consumer. And quite frankly, this is absolutely par for the course. This is totally my own experience in my last few years living in the United States, and I couldn't resist bringing it to your attention. This is from somebody who had lived in Japan, or is still living in Japan, and wishes to compare the experience of a Japanese relationship between a vendor and a consumer and an American one. I spent the past month in Colorado helping to start a new coffee shop in Longmont calling Red Frog Cafe. It's a partnership between my sister and me, she the talent and I the capital. Starting a new business is always challenging, but coming to this one from Japan where I live and work provided perspective on challenges that are uniquely American and they are not encouraging. For starters, the work ethic in the United States is abysmal. Contractors and other vendors simply don't show up. We went through 3 electrician appointment no-shows before finally getting a large firm to drop by and provide us with a quote. It was far too expensive. We called contractor friends with a question. Do you know any electricians who will show up and quote a fair price? We found one, but after too much effort. Among the contractors we did use, several showed up sloppily dressed with unkempt hair, spoke to us impolitely, and did their jobs poorly. Formerly clean walls were scratched or scuffed, wires were left exposed instead of being tucked away properly with cable ties, holes were cut unevenly, and so on. One particularly galling episode involved the property owner's maintenance team replacing ceiling tiles after an exterminator cleaned up a mess left by birds that had entered our leasehold when it was vacant. The original tiles were a rich brown color and in immaculate condition. The maintenance team sprayed, painted a different shade of brown on new tiles and put only a thin coat of that. Worse, they stacked them together when the paint was still wet, so bits of white tile and other debris stuck to the paint. Then they slapped the tiles into place with broken corners and in a checked pattern of mismatched colors. We hit the ceiling, so to speak, over that. Several phone calls and arguments later, we finally located one member of the maintenance team who would A, acknowledge that the colors were different, and B, agree that broken corners and bits of debris were not acceptable, and C, commit to fixing the problem. Over a couple of days of careful, slow work to repair the damage done, he made it right. Why couldn't it have been right from the start? Our point-of-sale system emerged as the best choice after online research. It had the most features, a good price, and boasted solid technical support. It was delivered by a man who knew nothing about it. The first thing he told us was that we'd need to install an Ethernet cable under our coffee bar, something his company had failed to mention when we bought the system. Had we known about that requirement, we could have included the cable in the bar's construction plan. Instead, we needed to work quickly to install it across the ceiling, down the wall, and under the bar in a way that was attractive and safe. Then the tutorial commenced. I'm not exaggerating in the following example of how it went. To start, you just click here. Wait a minute, that's not supposed to happen. Click, click, search, confusion, at last a screen pops up. Here's where you click and enter your ID. What's our ID? Oh, it's just one for now. We enter one and go to a screen that was supposed to be pre-populated with the shop's menu that my sister had submitted to the company in advance. Instead, we saw buttons to order roast beef and other genetic restaurant items without an espresso latte or drip coffee in sight. Now touch the buttons when the customer orders and you'll be all set. This isn't our menu. Right, but the remote team will get that going for you soon. When? We open in a couple of days and want to practice and train our staff. Soon. What about reports? Oh, just click here. Wait a minute. That's not supposed to happen. Hold on. Click, click. Scratch head. Actually, I'm just part of the sales team. I don't really know much about this software. And it's a massive, complicated program that you guys are just going to have to play with for a while. I mean, everything works. I know that. I just don't know how it works. No kidding. That's how badly it went. On our grand opening day, the machine still didn't accept credit cards, run reports, or properly display orders to customers. We kept calling our two contacts in an effort to get the thing running, but it was always just a couple of hours away from working. They were always 90% there, but never finished. My sister and her staff struggled to run the shop without an operational POS system, which we all viewed as no longer standing for point of sale, but rather piece of, you know what. After a few luckless days with our Keystone Cops support squad, I finally called the corporate main number to get a different crew on the task. The president of the company told me that the representative who'd sold us the system had been fired from the company a few weeks prior to our purchase, stolen the equipment, and sold it to us fraudulently through their local partner in Denver, who was now in violation of his reseller agreement by working with a person no longer affiliated with the firm. What? Can you believe this sequence of events? I contacted the local police to put me in touch with the Internet Crime Complaint Center to begin an investigation that would cross jurisdictions, in our case, from San Diego, where the POS company is based, to Denver, from where it had been delivered, to Longmont, where our shop is located. Less than a week after opening our new business in America, we were already filing fraud claims with the FBI. Nice society. Meanwhile, I helped my sister find an apartment near the shop so she wouldn't need to drive 45 minutes from our hometown in the mountains. At each place, I was told that she would need to undergo an extensive background check for homicides, sex-related crimes, drug charges, and other offenses that would not be tolerated. Anytime you include the general public in America, that's what you get. Again, nice society. Then, the taxes and regulations. We needed to register for business identification with the federal government, state of Colorado, and city of Longmont. We needed an insurance policy with $2 million worth of coverage in case somebody sues us for sipping hot coffee. Then we needed a workers' compensation policy in case anybody gets injured while making espresso, and unemployment insurance so we can pay a former employee's benefits when they stop working at the shop. We need to show business results to the landlord, who spelt that out on one of the 62 pages in our contract, pay quarterly taxes to three different offices, pay taxes on behalf of our workers every 2 weeks, and file more forms than you can imagine to more offices than you knew existed. Nice free market. Want to know how it would have gone in Japan? The lease agreement would have been one, at most, 2 pages. I know, because I asked a ramen shop owner to show me his after I worked my way through ours. All it says in Japan is how much the shop needs to pay each month, how much advance notice of termination is needed, and that the tenant will clear any major construction with the owner before proceeding. That's it. Our 62-page whopper included passages like this. Gross sales means the aggregate of the prices or rentals charged for all goods, wares, and merchandise sold, leased, licensed, or delivered, and the charges for all services performed by tenant in, at, from, or arising out of the use of premises and internet sales, which are either originated at terminals in the leased premises or picked up by customers at the leased premises during each lease year, whether by tenant, subtenant, licensee, concessionaire, or other person, whether sold or leased on credit, or paid by cash, check, barter, or otherwise, whether the merchandise is delivered or the services rendered from the leased premises or elsewhere, including sales or leases across the counter, orders taken on the telephone, mail orders, sales or leases from mechanical devices or vending machines, deposits, is not refunded to customers, and layaway sales, except that the following shall not be included as gross sales, or if previously included in any lessee year, may be deducted by subsequently from gross sales reported for such lease year. And so on. That one sentence in its entirety is 239 words long. The whole contract minus attachments is 35,200 words long. Good luck, entrepreneurs. No wonder private sector job growth ended 10 years ago. In Japan, every contractor would have been on time, in uniform, well-spoken, and polite. The work would have been completed on time and within budget, with all walls, floors, and other affected areas left cleaner than when the team arrived. Our point-of-sale system would have been delivered and installed by a representative who knew it inside and out. Our menu would have been pre-installed as agreed, and the representative would have walked us through each step of a typical day at the machine. If we had had any questions during the first week, somebody would have come in person to help us. It goes without saying that the machine would not have been stolen and that the police would not have needed to get involved. As for an apartment for my sister, not one would have required background criminal checks or other insulting steps reflective of a society gone wrong. Criminals are extremely rare in Japan, so rare that it's not worth the effort of assuming everybody is one of them. In America, we have to assume the worst because we get it so damned often. As far as taxes are concerned, we would have had one point of contact at our local city hall. Two copies of the same two-page form are all that's required, one for the town and the other for the country. Once we filled those out, we would have received the only business identification number required. That's it. Done. Once per quarter, we would have gone to City Hall and paid taxes in person or arranged for somebody to visit our shop to collect the funds. As for insurance, Japan doesn't suffer petty lawsuits the way America does. Nobody ever gets sued for serving hot coffee, for slips and falls, and other tried and true techniques used by America's growing loser class to get a free lunch. Japan's unemployment system is provided and managed by the government with tax funds. Businesses don't have to worry about it. In short, business owners in Japan can focus on the challenges of their business, not the challenges presented by a society off the rails. America has lost its pride and lost the spirit of free enterprise. It's pathetic to do a bad job, sell stolen goods, amass a criminal record, and look for shortcut ways to get money, such as suing innocent businesses or claiming unemployment fraudulently. Yet these are daily occurrences in America. The corrosion starts early. I drove by Longmont High School in the morning and saw slovenly kids standing around light poles in awful clothing, smoking cigarettes, and even pot one time. My car window was cracked open and a smell of dope wafted in. You know what I see when taking a morning walk past Japanese high schools in my office? Kids in pressed uniforms carrying backpacks stuffed with the homework they completed the night before. They say good morning to me when I pass by. When I hear them chatting, it's frequently about test scores, because they're all trying to get into the best schools possible to create the best careers possible. When I hear American students talking, it's about ways to beat the urine analysis tests they're required to take as part of their school production. Japan is still a proud society. Workers are proud of the job they do well. Students are proud of the tests they pass with flying colors. And citizens are proud of the lives they've created through achievement. The society welcomes businesses and makes it easy for them to get up and running in a way that helps the local economy. America is lacking both ambition and pride these days. From the coast-to-coast disaster that happened when people without income signed up for homes they couldn't afford, to the electricians in Longmont who don't even show up to do a job they agreed to do, to dope-smoking students whose only goal is to beat their next urinalysis. Evidence of America's rotting core is everywhere. Couldn't have said it better myself, ladies and gentlemen. Time for my information. My name is Richard Martin. This is the wake-up call on PRN served to you from Singapore through the good offices of our studios in New York City. If you would like to call in with questions, comments, rants, reflections on my opening statement or other whatever it is you have to say, please feel free to do so. Your comments are welcomed of whatever nature. And we will talk about them here on PRN. And the number to call is 888-873-4643. Once again, the call-in number is 888-873-4643. And if you'd like to send in an email, please feel free to do so. The email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. Once more, the email address is RM@GFAWD.com. And if you want to call me personally with your questions about what to do with money or your economic problems and conundrum, please feel free to call me anytime on my direct line through Sarasota. That's a call to a 941 area code. And the number is 941-441-1682. Again, my personal direct line number is 941-441-1682. All right. Well, I thought I would talk a little bit about the comparison between what you find in Greece today and what you find in California, and why indeed California is in fact to be considered the next Greece. We've heard a lot of trouble about California. We've seen pictures of poor old Arnold Schwarzenegger, not quite the Terminator anymore, jowls protruding from both sides of his very sleep-stricken face. Quite frankly, not the governor he claimed to be when he arrived in office several years ago. Well, California has a $20 billion budget gap despite last year's ravaging cutbacks. Without a federal bailout, Schwarzenegger will terminate at least six major state programs, including Healthy Families, Core Works, Adult Day Health Care, In-Home Supportive Services, California Food Assistance Program, and all funding for transitional housing placement for foster kids. 23,000 teachers have received provisional pink slips, notifying them that their jobs are on the chopping block. The $20 billion gap does not, by the way, include nearly $200 billion in loans and other unstated debts. California has the lowest S&P debt rating of any United States state, an A minus. California has America's fewest emergency rooms, 7 per 1 million people. And that comes from the American College of Emergency Physicians, which gave California a failing grade for access to emergency care. In 23 years, California erected 23 prisons and only one university. California has fallen from number 1 in per pupil spending to number 48, and that's since the late 1970s. California spends $859 million a year on imprisoned illegal immigrants. There are roughly 19,000 illegal immigrants in state prisons, representing 11% of all inmates. That's costing $970 million during the current fiscal year. The feds kick in a measly $111 million. Would somebody tell me why California has to take on the mantle of people who decide to commit crimes in the state of California? California spends $500 million each year on wildfire damage and damage control. So that's California's lot in life, to have to spend to clear up the damage through nature, through Mother Nature, which, by the way, is America's problem. I don't know why it's considered California's problem. America, last time I looked, is supposed to be a unified country. Couldn't they all kick in to help on the wildfire damage and damage control? And by the way, get ready for the fourth straight summer of the California drought. Seven of America's most unemployed cities are in California, including, by the way, the record-breaking El Centro, at 27.3% unemployed, ladies and gentlemen. And that's the U3 figure. That's not even the U6 figure. Did you know that nearly 70,000 California homes were foreclosed on in February? The nation's most. The average home in Merced, California, lost 63% of its value in the last 4 years. Well, 2010 home sales are down from last year. Well, California has no central bank and can't print money to stave off debt. This is everything. The inability of Greece to give itself some monetary flexibility was devastating, and it's the reason the UK is not facing an acute crisis, despite a very high level of debt. UK has its own currency. Greece is imprisoned in the euro. Well, eventually California will need a bailout from Washington. But while European leaders came together for Greece and their pigs, can you imagine a fractious Congress saving the day? Very, very, very sad, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry. Sorry it has to be like that. None of the extraordinary efforts that have been taken or are now being contemplated by the world's governments address the underlying structural issues that bedevil the global economy. None. None of these bailouts, these quantitative easing pieces of nonsense, otherwise known as money printing, none of it does anything for the economy. And that is why I keep telling you and have sold you over and over again, this is not a recovery, ladies and gentlemen. This is not a recovery. You are not seeing a recovery. It doesn't matter what lies are being bandied about. There is no recovery. And you are soon to find this out the hard way, because the government's not going to tell you, and business is not going to tell you. Just your own personal experience is going to tell you what is going on. And by the way, the structural issues that are not being dealt with encompass everything from unsustainable obligations to the citizenry to inefficient and ineffective regulatory structures that veritably beg to be abused by the best and brightest now occupying trading desks on Wall Street. And given the recent financial crisis, you might be tempted to sniff at the idea that these are the best and brightest. But consider who it was that got essentially paid in full during the collapse. You might want to retract that sniff. One thing is for sure, the Wall Street traders can run circles around the ideologues stumbling around the dark in Washington, dolts who still think that they can fix things by laying around hundreds of billions, trillions even, of new debt and piles upon piles of new regulation. Regulation that is absolutely uncalled for, regulation which perfectly well existed before, but the regulators refuse to apply. And it doesn't mean, of course, the Washington crowd can't accidentally take a seat on the destroy economy button, which is what makes them so very dangerous and what makes their latest antics worth closely monitoring. Regardless, nothing, and I mean nothing, is currently in the works that will repair the fractured foundations of the economy. And much of what is being promoted right now will only make things worse. Ladies and gentlemen, entropy is reaching the tipping point. It's leading to a big change in business as usual. And while the center may be able to hold for another year or even five, I increasingly believe that we're going to see a fundamental change in the world as we know it before the current decade is over.
Well, this is PRN, Progressive Radio Network. This is Peter Roth, the host of Energy Stew on Thursday nights at 7:30. The show is about life's patterns, how they influence our lives, and how our own patterns influence life around us. It's about knowing ourselves better and understanding the mechanics of our life journey. We have wonderful guests who have made great contributions to the knowledge of ourselves. Tune in on Thursday evenings at 7:30 for Energy Stew on Progressive Radio Network. This is Mitchell J. Rabin to tell you that we have two new time slots every Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network. Join me as I interview and dialogue with the sung and unsung heroes of society with passion and with commitment. Scientists, healers, filmmakers, musicians, environmentalists, and gurus on Mondays, and a call-in show where you'll be the focus on Wednesdays. Again, Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m., join Mitchell Rabin as together we create a better world.
The Progressive Radio Network is the home for progressive minds. It's the place where progressives get together to discuss important topics with informed opinions, minus the agenda. PRN is the place for fresh, stimulating, commercial-free radio content from leading progressives all over the world every day. The Progressive Radio Network, making the world a more informed place, one mind at a time.
Hi, this is Mike Fader. I'm doing a new show here on PRN every Thursday following Gary Null from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. It's called The Turning Point. What will we talk about? Well, everything from birth to death and most things in between. I'll be using stories in the news and personal observations from my own life. And from time to time, I'll be taking your calls. So please join me, Mike Fader, every Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time for The Turning Point on PRN.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Well, maybe it's all about false pride. You know, the need to counterattack those who would dare attack, for example, the euro. how interesting it was to see the sharpness of the political rhetoric over the weekend from the European political elite. Please fund our lifestyle, Mr. Market, but don't hold us to our commitments. A battle of the politicians against the markets. I am determined to win, German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Unfounded, off-the-wall suggestions and speculation, EC President Manuel Barroso. Confront speculators mercilessly. Know once and for all what lies in store for them. President of France, Nicolas Sarkozy. It is a sad deflationary reality when $1 trillion can only buy you 400 points on the Dow. Too much debt, my friends. There is too much debt, and that is the nation of the nature of our problem here. The debt burden of the U.S. government is awful, but that is not the only problem. The private debt is even worse. The total debt is more important than just monitoring the government debt alone. The total credit market debt is over $52 trillion, and the total government debt, when you take into account the state and local governments and the debt used to fund the Social Security, is about $15 trillion of that. That leaves $37 trillion of private debt. The government debt will head towards $30 trillion, while the private debt will decline towards $20 trillion as the private sector either defaults on its debt or pays it off. The government debt increases will not be enough to ease the pain the public will suffer during the debt contraction of the private sector. And this is similar to what took place in Japan starting in 1989 when they entered their secular bear market and lost two decades. America has just experienced its first lost decade. It's the invisible hand of the interest on the debt burden that's making the U.S. public so uncomfortable. And until they realize that the problem lies with them, they will continue to go to tea parties and protest the party in power, whichever one it is. But that's not the end of the story. As onerous as the debt, the private debt is near term, the unfunded liabilities of government will have to be dealt with in the not too distant future also, and that amounts to almost $80 trillion, with just Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid alone. This is not a very pretty picture for America and its stock market. And if the scenario that I painted in the opening comments today of my talk are anything to go by, there isn't much hope for America today. And if anybody can tell me or anybody else what's going to turn that around, you people will be lionized for the rest of existence. Because that example of what I told you earlier on this morning was exactly how I had to live in the United States in the last 5 years of my time there. And it got worse and worse and worse. And I know that all of you experience exactly the same thing. I know it. And I ask you where the salvation comes from, because I don't see it anywhere. This is not a liquidity issue. This is not a crisis which will be solved by the installation of a new government. This is truly a social generational problem. And I don't have any idea at all about how it will be fixed. And you can listen to any of the pundits that come on frequently on radios now and TV and in the newspapers and in the media, because it's now considered cool to be a little bit crisis-ridden and full of the apocalypse of the future. But none of them address this, because there is nothing to be said. And that's why I say you need to leave, ladies and gentlemen. It's not a question of hope. It's not a question of wondering how these little problems can be fixed. The whole thing has turned the corner, and there can only be deep trouble ahead and a crisis, a social crisis of proportions that nobody in history has ever had to face. You do not want to be in the United States when that happens. All right, well, I did get an email from Marek, who said, "Dear Richard, I know that in the past you mentioned that Greece will default on their payment coming up next week. Do you still think this way after the $1 trillion bailout plan was approved last weekend? And based on this, how will the value of the euro and dollar be affected? Thank you very much, Marek." Well, Marek, I didn't say that. I don't know. I'm sorry. There must have been some kind of misunderstanding. I didn't mention the default of their due payment next week. I didn't. I think that must have been either somebody else or a misunderstanding. But I think that Greece has been bought about a year or 18 months of time. It's not going to change anything. It's just going to delay the whole process of collapse. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I have talked about a depression lasting 20 years. This is the kind of reason why a depression which should have been a recession might have lasted, say, 18 months, gets dragged on for 20 years, and just look to Japan for reasons for this. It is because the governments and powers that be try to save their own skins and their own positions of power by doing what to them appears to be a panacea for the opinions and goodwill of the people. But they know perfectly well that this doesn't change anything. And interestingly enough, some of you may know that the minutes of the Fed meetings get published exactly 5 years after the meetings have taken place. And now what we're beginning to see is absolute proof positive that the Fed knew in advance that the whole system was about to collapse. And they just tried to prop it up. They tried to prop it up as long as they could, but they knew it was going to happen. And if you study the writings, or rather the transcripts of the meetings, as I have done recently, and I haven't had a chance to put something together for you because it's really quite complicated, because I have to know what to pick and choose from in order to make my point. But I can tell you that whether it's Cohn or Susan Beese, or whether it's Greenspan himself, who was still in at the head of the Fed in those days, they all give themselves away. And when Greenspan comes on and talks about how nobody could have known what was about to happen, that's a pure lie. I'm not even going to get emotional about this. It's a pure, simple, outright lie. If I want to get emotional about something, it's the fact that nobody picks him up. Nobody challenges him on it. Nobody's prepared to say anything to ruffle the feathers of Greenspan and his reputation, which must be deteriorating by the day, because some people know what's going on and are talking about it. And, you know, history will not be kind to Greenspan, but basically how it works. All right. So I don't think I have right now any other emails, so I will talk a little bit about what's been going on as regards Goldman Sachs, because the recent problems experienced by Goldman Sachs actually highlight just how far the financial system has lapsed from the days of gentlemanly capitalism. You know, change in itself is neither good nor bad. It is what it is. It's an inevitable feature of human life. It must be managed as such. But change on Wall Street has by and large been managed poorly by being left to the most self-interested forces. There's a quote from Adam Smith, who's best known as the author of the Bible of Capitalism, The Wealth of Nations. But he actually wrote an equally important book 2 decades earlier entitled The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And he wrote the following, and I quote, "This disposition to admire, almost to worship, the rich and the powerful, and to despise, or at least to neglect, persons of poor and mean condition, though necessary both to establish and to maintain the distinction of ranks and the order of society, is at the same time the great and most universal cause of the corruption of our moral sentiments." End of quote. So what Adam Smith pointed out more than 200 years ago is equally true today. Our society, fed by the media, worships wealth at the expense of other values that are far more important to a cohesive and healthy society. The entire mission of the Wealth of Nations was to try to recognize man for what he is, a social animal who is reliant on the good opinions of his neighbors, and to develop the optimal economic system to harness that human essence for the good of all mankind. Smith believed that the system was a free market, and history has by and large proven him correct. But the United States has strayed from a free market model to a system that privatizes gains and socializes losses. During the last two decades, the American economy has suffered a series of legal, fiscal, and monetary policies that have favored speculation over production. The result has been the financialization of the economy, which has been characterized in economic terms by an unhealthy growth in debt at all levels of the economy, and in cultural terms by the monetization of all values. Entities such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were perfect examples of how the free market had been corrupted before the 2000 financial crisis. The crisis itself demonstrated, however, that the logic of the system required all the large institutions to suffer from a similar flaw. Yet these flaws were not inevitable, even at the height of the crisis. They were deliberate political choices. While stakeholders of some institutions, such as Lehman Brothers, were wiped out, those of other firms were not, and some were even made whole. The most egregious example of this was the handling of the American International Group, or AIG, the insurance giant that morphed itself into a giant hedge fund while enriching the officials responsible for some of the most ill-informed judgments in financial history. There was no reason for the government to handle the AIG failure in a manner that made whole foreign counterparties and Goldman Sachs or alternatives, including offering a blanket credit guarantee to the insurance company that would have calmed markets and obviated the necessity of the company paying out 100 cents on the dollar for its reckless insurance bets on the synthetic mortgage obligations. While the result, which was an avoidance of the extinction level event that an AIG failure would have been for the financial system, while the result was a correct one, the means by which it was achieved furthered the agenda of socializing losses and privatizing gains and bred deep distrust in the government and the system. Much of the crisis could have been avoided if the policymakers and investors had operated under realistic assumptions about how markets and economies work. Several years ago, Greenspan himself described the failure of interest rates to react in the manner he expected as a conundrum. We know that Mr. Greenspan was operating under a false set of assumptions about human nature, as well as a misguided understanding about how market participants behave. If Greenspan had been an acolyte of Hyman Minsky instead of Ayn Rand, he would have been less susceptible to such a fatal conceit. But beyond that, the real conundrum in modern markets is the continued reliance of investors and policymakers on two false mantras. The first is that markets are efficient, and the second is that investors are rational. Both assertions are so decidedly specious that one has to question both the sanity or the intelligence of those who cling to them. Yet these two bugaboos are supported by reams of academic research and much of the investment establishment. It is my contention that these delusions are why capital continues to be terminally mismanaged by the professional investment class. With few exceptions, professional investors in all asset classes have produced at best mediocre returns for their investors. There are exceptions, of course, but they are essentially of statistical insignificance. Private equity is one asset class that comes to mind. But the same criticism can be applied to virtually all asset managers. Capital is not a thing or a category. Capital is a living, breathing phenomenon. capital is an expression of the human relationships that generate economic value. And just as these relationships are dynamic, so is capital. The most important attribute of capital is it functions in the real world, is that it is a relationship. As such, it has the capacity to change form. This is often described as its liquidity function. Capital is also a human construct. It is not something found in nature or subject to scientific laws, despite the misguided attempts of today's rocket scientists to claim that it possesses such qualities. Most importantly, capital is unstable. If capital were better understood for what it is, it could be better managed and regulated. Because capital is not properly understood, however, it is abused. And the consequences of that abuse are not theoretical, they are human. America's ill-begotten economic policies have exacted an incalculable toll on the citizens of this country and around the world. Millions of people have lost their jobs and their homes. The official jobless rate is still around 10%, and the real jobless rate is still closer to 20% when discouraged and underutilized workers are included. Economic hardship and the stresses of unemployment have led to the breakup of families and higher rates of addiction and suicide. At the end of last year, 1 in 8 Americans was receiving part of his or her nutrition from food stamps, including 1 in 4 children. And that figure has just been republished as 1 in 6 Americans. Communities around the country are being destroyed by house foreclosures. And the American heartland has been decimated by the failure of the American automobile industry. And the country is facing even greater challenges ahead in terms of caring for its aging population, dealing with the unsustainable fiscal deficits, reducing the growing cost of health care, not to mention the incalculable costs of dealing with the inevitable but unknowable black swans that are bound to occur, such as Gulf oil spills, terrorist attacks, or nuclear proliferation. Only a sound financial system will place the country in a position to deal with these challenges. And I don't know where that sound financial system is going to come from, ladies and gentlemen. That is why I talk about the death wish of America on my Sunday discussion groups. The self-destructive death wish behavior that I described at the beginning of my show today, in the way in which these people deal with each other, and how frustrating it is, and how desperate you feel when you're in a situation where you are vulnerable, either in a health context or in the context of some technological gadgetry that has gone awry, because you get innately this feeling that nobody is going to help you, that nobody actually cares. And that's what it's all about. It's about the dog-eat-dog attitude of America today, a very, very frightening, terrifying country to live in. Not the country I signed up for, ladies and gentlemen, when I went to live there 22 years ago. All right, we have a caller. He is Tom in Queens, and he has a question about the stand on value-added tax. Hello, Tom. Are you there?
Hello, Richard. The mainstream media and some notion regarding the value of maybe economical problem. Hello?
Tom, I'm sorry, you're cutting out. I didn't hear any of that. I understand that you have been removed from the system. I don't know what happened there. I couldn't hardly hear anything, but anyway, I will continue with a little bit of news to end up with here. For the past 6 quarters, U.S. global corporations reaped vast profits by slashing headcount, inventories, and expenses across the enterprise. Even better from the view of the financial media, desperate to generate the shameless propaganda of good news, the low level of profits in the first quarter of 2009 enabled apparently fantastic growth in profits via the year-over-year comparisons favored by financial propagandists. Meanwhile, behind the smokescreen of bogus profit growth, global sales are still falling when compared to 2005 to 2007. Indeed, even year-on-year comparisons have shown that global giants such as Caterpillar saw 11% declines in sales even as their profits in US dollars rose handsomely. And the obvious but rarely mentioned reality is that all these corporations have already plucked all the low-hanging fruit in terms of cost savings and reduced payroll. Well, this is the moment of truth, ladies and gentlemen, because from here on, they will have to grow earnings via growing revenues. And if we subtract the bogus phantom jobs created by the birth-death model and the temporary Census Bureau jobs, the economy is staggering along the zero line, neither creating jobs nor losing them. If that is the best that stupendous stimulation via federal spending and zero interest rates can do to stimulate organic, non-governmentally created growth in employment, it certainly suggests that any reduction in federal stimulus spending and the flagrant pumping of money via the Federal Reserve monetary easing will result in a renewed decline in employment. It doesn't take much of a crystal ball to foresee massive layoffs as state and local governments are finally forced to face the music of reduced tax revenues and higher employee pension costs. As usual, the media is touting a 3% rise in tax revenues as proof the recession is over, yet few note that tax revenues have dropped by 20 or 30% in many locales. A 3% rise is not enough to repair the damage done by 2 years of recession and all the accounting tricks and gimmicks which the California legislature and other states' leaders have deployed to mask the true depth of their deficits. With costs of employment rising by the day, healthcare, employment taxes, etc., very few private businesses have high enough gross margins to justify hiring anyone permanently. Contract or temp workers are the solution, and any increase in freelance headcounts does not presage a surge in permanent hiring. If there is an army of unemployed willing to work for far less than a permanent employee costs, why bother increase permanent headcount? The global economies are still pursuing the savings of global wage arbitrage, and every increase in structural costs in the U.S., with healthcare going up 7 to 15% every year, taxes going up, etc., only increases the attractiveness of overseas employees and contract freelance workers in the U.S. The more the MFM and government leaders tout a return to growth, the more tenuous and threadbare their shrill claims sound to an increasingly skeptical public. Borrowing another $5 to $10 trillion to bail out weak Eurozone nations and stimulate a deflationary global economy may keep the patient alive a few months or years longer, but the past model of basing growth on serial credit bubbles and bailouts is no longer sustainable. Giving Greece another $10 billion will not magically enable it to make an interest payment or roll over old debt. That game is over, though the players are hoping to buy into the charade one more time. Nothing structural has been fixed, as I've said over and over again, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing has been done to address the problems of the economy. There is nothing to address the deeper structural imbalances between high-saving Northern Europe and the spendthrift Club Med countries of Southern Europe that used the euro as a credit card. Basically, the North's abundance created a low-interest euro bond market that underpriced the risk of investments in the South. This charade of what they call recovery may run a few more months, but if you scrape away the noise, the underlying trends are simply unsustainable. Well, we have Tom back again in Queens. Tom, I hope you're there. We have just a few moments left. Would you like to state your point, please?
Yes, Richard, hi.
Yeah, I think that value-added tax might be a short-term solution for United States. However, I'm afraid that that might increase spending in the long run. You know, after the small recovery, let's say.
Well, you know, value-added taxes work in a dirigist society where the government really takes control of the reins of the economy, but it doesn't work in the United States. Taxation per se is not the solution. I'm not saying that taxation is necessarily wrong or that even a value-added tax is necessarily wrong. I'm just saying that with the amount of small business which forms such a huge proportion of the economy in the United States, any kind of additional tax of that nature is simply going against the grain of how the American economy is formulated. So I doubt that it will have the same effect as it would have in a European context, where value-added taxes have been very successful in providing the extra discretionary tax income that the government needs. I'm all in favor of VAT, by the way. I think income tax should be reduced and value-added taxes should replace them. But as usual, I'm in a minority, and I doubt that I get very far with that one. What's your opinion? What do you think about a value-added tax yourself, Tom?
Well, I think it's better to pay value-added tax, let's say, instead of paying outrageous property taxes. You know, that would be a nice trade-off. You know, the less you're buying, the less taxes you're paying as a value-added tax. However, you're staying in your house on your land, and you don't have to worry really about, you know, being kicked out because you don't have a job and you have no means to pay for property tax.
I agree. I think that where you have non-discretionary expenses such as a house, it seems somewhat superfluous to make people pay large amounts of tax, which put them in exactly the jeopardy you describe. When you have discretionary purchases, I think a tax is more suitable and more justifiable and appropriate, because then you can pick and choose as to what you actually, you know, feel you want to buy. I mean, already America accepts that food is a necessity, a staple, and it doesn't tax food. I wonder why they think they need to tax homes and property. Not something that I really am very familiar with. I'm not an expert on the tax situation, but you bring up a very good point, Tom, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much for your call. Ladies and gentlemen, as always, we are coming to the end of another show. I will tell you that I'm going to be talking in much more detail about the destiny of America on Sunday in the discussion group, and I encourage you please to come in with your views and opinions, because that's what we do on Sundays. We talk together, at least hopefully we do. So please have some questions ready, pick up your phones and call us on Sunday, and I look forward to hearing from you then. And in any case, if I don't get to talk to you on Sunday, I hope I will talk to you again next Monday. And I wish you all a wonderful weekend, so take care of yourselves, and I will talk to you then. Bye for now.